I call Senate Arctic Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, February 26, 2026, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Please turn off your cell phones. Members present today, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Wilikowski, Vice Chair Senator Stevens, and myself, I'm Senator Giesel. Senator Olson is in Finance Committee right now and is therefore excused. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Juliana and to Chloe, who are helping us out recording the minutes and helping us with the audio. We have two items on our agenda today. First of all, a presentation from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power with a presentation on nuclear power. And if we have time, we'll talk about some rural energy costs as well. And then we have Senate Joint Resolution 24, honoring the relationship with Greenland. So to speak to us, first of all, related to nuclear power and its potential in Alaska, is Gwen Holdman. She is the chief scientist and program lead at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So welcome, Ms. Holdman.
Thank you, Senator and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gwen Holdman. I am the chief scientist at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I reside in Fairbanks, Alaska. So thank you for inviting me here today to give you an update on nuclear energy. And as you mentioned, if there's some time, I have some updates on some research we've been doing related to the cost of delivered power in rural Alaska as well. So I just broke the presentation that I'm going to give you down, just give a little bit of an overview on nuclear energy. I know that the members of the committee here have heard quite a bit about this before, and so I'll give a little bit of an update, review quickly Senate Bill 177 that was regarding the Alaska State Statutes on Nuclear Energy, talk a little bit about an update on projects that are currently impacting Alaska potentially. I thought that would be of interest. I recently had an opportunity to visit Finland and the Onkalo long-term waste repository there. So I've got a couple slides there that I would share with you since this is an Arctic Affairs committee. And then topic two, if we have time, some rural energy considerations. So, all right. So just very quickly, I do want to mention that we did put this guide that we have created on your desks for you, which we recently put together. This is a draft version for community leaders or for utilities that have questions about advanced or small nuclear reactors. This is a topic that that has gotten a fair amount of attention in Alaska, but there's still a lot of questions, a little bit of lack of full understanding of what the difference between an advanced reactor is versus conventional reactors. And so we're really hoping one of our roles that we feel is really to try to get information out to Alaska, to all Alaskans about what this technology is and what it could mean for the future here. And so just a few of the attributes, which these icons come directly out of the document that I shared with you. They're typically smaller. They're scalable and modular. So the idea is that you might have multiple smaller units that could be combined to represent a larger nuclear power plant complex, essentially. They are modular in that they're built often in a factory, assembled in a factory, and then transported to a site almost fully built. And so that's the second one. That means that we can also place these closer to where there's demand. So for example, one thing that's of real interest is potentially pairing these with, for example, data centers or new loads. Or in our case, and the third one here is that they have the potential to provide thermal energy as well. So because these are safer than conventional nuclear, we can place them closer to where people live as well. And so the idea of using the heat for things like district heating is also much more possible than with conventional nuclear. They do have many of these passive safety features, which means that they are much less likely to result in any kind of release of radioactive materials into the environment if an incident does occur. Unlike conventional nuclear, that requires active management of safety features. So you basically have to be providing electricity or actively managing, removing heat from the reactor, or there is the potential for it to melt down. Instead, in this particular case, if you walk away from it without touching the reactor, the nuclear reaction is naturally going to wind down. It's going to shut down. So it'll have the opposite effect, and that makes it intrinsically safer in terms of the way that we might deploy these in society. Yes.
Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry, just a very quick question. Gwen, I probably haven't been paying attention. I've been in Alaska too long. Do we still have large commercial nuclear power plants in the U.S.?
Yes, through the chair. Thank you for that question, Senator Stevens. I actually have a slide that shows that. And yes, I'll just cut to the chase, about 20% of the electric power in the United States is produced from nuclear. That's about the same as all renewables, including hydroelectric, put together. So they're actually a major part of our baseload energy supply in the U.S. They just don't get as much attention as some of the other sources.
Thank you.
Yes. So they are also using newer fuels as well. And so a lot of the safety attributes that are associated with these new generation of reactors are also built into the actual configuration, the geometric configuration of the fuel itself. And they don't need water, typically, for cooling. And so a lot of these reactors, you see those iconic kind of towers, the cooling towers and things like that. That's because they're using some sort of typically a source of water, maybe a river, something like that. In this case, they don't require water for cooling, which means that you can place them in many more locations. And also that's another vector of potential environmental contamination that's removed as well. So these are quite different from conventional legacy reactor design. And that's something that we just want to make sure that Alaskans are aware of and familiar with.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just on that point, I think it – and I know you and I have talked about this.
Yes.
And I think it would be helpful maybe for the public that's listening to – because they think of Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima. Explain, like, the worst possible thing that can happen with one of these one of these very small nuclear reactors. Could you have a meltdown? Could you have, you know, sort of a Fukushima or a Chernobyl type of incident with one of these?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. That's a great question. And I actually have to say, when we worked on legislation to update Alaska statutes on nuclear energy, this committee actually asked a lot of really terrific questions related to that. And so one of the things we've been doing is working with Idaho National Lab and other federal agencies to really understand, you know, what this means and what inherent safety means. And so essentially for these reactors, they have a negative reactivity coefficient. So they're going to – they really can't melt down. And experts really don't like to say can't. Like they're very reluctant to say there's like a 0% chance that a reactor could do X, Y, or Z. But in reality, they operate off of they shut down a reaction, they cool down based off of conventional laws of physics and thermodynamics as we understand them. And so there's really virtually no way that they could melt down the way a conventional reactor, the ones that we've seen where these incidents exist. Some of the fuels, like, for example, TRISO fuel, which is encapsulated in tiny little poppy seed size particles. You know, the idea is that if there was an incident, the fuel can really only travel as far as a solid can travel. And so, you know, those are some of the attributes that are associated with these, like in at least the smaller reactors, the micro reactors. The idea is that the area of containment or the safety zone could end as close as like at the door of the facility, because there's not really that potential for nearby contamination of the environment. Here's a life-size mock-up of one of these micro reactors, and I do want to mention that there's like several different scales of reactor designs that we're talking about here. So this is the smallest sort of category. They're called micro reactors. This would be something that would be akin to the size of the Eielson Air Force Base proposed micro reactor. So I'll talk about that in a little bit. This is a Westinghouse design. This is not the reactor that was selected for that particular project, but it just gives you an idea roughly of the size of this kind of a project. And this is in Saskatchewan. So this isn't an actual reactor, right? This is just a mock-up of what it will look like. And the reason why it's here at the Saskatchewan Research Council is because Saskatchewan does not currently have any nuclear, but they are very excited about this being their future energy source. So they have a plan to really develop a nuclear energy industry in their province. They really want to have nuclear operators and really build up local local expertise around the technology. And so they've decided, the province has decided to invest in one of these small SMRs. So this will be one of the first of these particular reactors that's deployed in the world, actually, in this particular case in Saskatchewan. And so we partner with them a lot. So it was a great opportunity. We partner with Saskatchewan a lot, so it was a great opportunity to go there and learn a little bit from their strategy from a policy standpoint and also from a technical standpoint. I am sprinkling in as many Arctic references as I can here with the understanding this is the Arctic Affairs Committee. So, again, this is the primer that we prepared with ICER, with the Institute for Social and Economic Research, a sister institute at the University of Alaska Anchorage that we work with a lot on nuclear energy. And this is actually a deliverable under a grant that we have from the Department of Energy through the Nuclear Energy University Program. It's geared more toward smaller communities in Alaska that have questions around nuclear energy, but it's, I think, we tried to make it applicable to a larger audience, and it's currently under peer review through the Nuclear Energy Working Group in the state and others, including the National Labs. But I thought I would share it with you today. And I should also acknowledge that there was a 2023 capital appropriation from the Alaska State Legislature. We've received funding at a few sort of key points of time from the legislature to continue to explore this technology. And so that was one of the things that has allowed us to do some of the background research and investigation that relates to this document. Here's some other ones that we prepared. The first two there are at the request of the state legislature in 2011. That was our first real foray into looking at small nuclear at the request of the legislature directed through the Alaska Energy Authority, and then we updated that document 10 years later. So that's something we've been working on quite a bit. We've also been working with individual communities that are interested in the technology, Nome being an example. We have been helping try to educate Alaskans and provide opportunities for dialogue and discussion. We've been doing a lot of public engagement. We've had about half a dozen or more town halls in different communities across Alaska. We have organized the Nuclear Energy Working Group, which actually just held a meeting 2 days ago looking at the U.S. Process for handling waste disposal of nuclear fuels. And we've been holding things like workshops and other educational opportunities. This is a workshop we organized last month that was a virtual workshop. It was the best attended workshop that we've ever had that's associated with the Alaska Sustainable Energy Conference as part of this kind of continuing conversations, deeper dives into specific technologies. And so we had almost 400 people registered for this, and a little bit under 300 actually participated. So this is to answer Senator Stevens' questions about the U.S. nuclear capacity. And so you can kind of see here we built out a lot of these reactors between the late 60s and just before the 90s. And then there's been a really long period of time where there's been very little activity. And even the activity that has occurred, like you see the couple of reactors that were brought online just a couple years ago, that was the Georgia Vogtle reactor. And that was actually about a decade almost behind schedule in terms of getting that up and running. And it went very significantly. There was very significant cost overruns associated with that. Part of that was because the Fukushima incident happened in Japan during that period of time, and that forced the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to change some of their approaches to licensing of reactors. So they picked a pretty bad time to be halfway through developing a project. So I just want to mention that Alaska was one of the first states in the country that actually recognized this separate class of smaller advanced reactors through SB 177. So that received a lot of attention, not just in Alaska, but also at the national level. It did. It was specific to reactors that are under 50 megawatts. So these are smaller reactor designs. Basically, these micro reactors, such as the Eielson one I'll talk about in a minute here, you know, there is also the possibility that if there was going to be a project on the rail belt, it might be larger than 50 megawatts. So that's just something to maybe put on the radar here, that there is at least some interest among the utilities for potentially exploring this as an alternative to natural gas. So on a rail belt, a 5 or 10 megawatt reactor isn't going to make much of a difference. It would have to be a larger scale. All right, so moving on to a few projects that I just wanted to give you a quick update on. This is probably the one that's received the most attention, the Eielson Air Force Base microreactor. And so they achieved a big milestone in last summer when they identified Oklo as the company that they wanted to work with and issued a notice of intent to award to Oklo. That doesn't necessarily mean for sure the project is moving forward, but they're working on beginning contract negotiations. They still need to undergo NRC licensing. There are none of these small microreactors that to date have received NRC licensing. And in fact, Oklo did actually was the first one to start to go through that effort back in 2022. And the NRC actually did send them back to the table at that point in time and said, go away, you need to do a little more on answering these specific questions for us. But what's happening now is that you're seeing many of these start to be organized as pilot projects with Idaho National Lab. And so the picture on the bottom there is an artist rendering of a groundbreaking – well, it's not – no, that's a real picture. Sorry. The top one is an artistic rendering, but the bottom one is a real picture at Idaho National Lab. They're actually breaking the ground there to build their first reactor at INL. And so there's really been a huge amount of effort moving forward. That's going to be a larger reactor. It's 75 megawatts. The one that is intended for Eielson is much smaller. It's 5 megawatts. I mean, there's some questions that have come up as to whether there might be the potential for making that a larger project that could be more of a public-private partnership and potentially produce power beyond the base footprint. But that is not a formal conversation at this point in time, but it would be of interest. And so Oklo is also one of these 10 companies that's selected under this nuclear reactor program. There was a number of different executive orders put out by the Trump administration very early on that related to nuclear, related to like accelerating the licensing process through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and getting some of these test reactors or pilot projects operational as soon as possible. I think that July of this summer seems very optimistic to me, but I do just want to say this is one of those technologies we keep talking about being 10 years away, and that 10-year time horizon is starting to shrink quite a bit. So these are coming very quickly. Project Pele is a fully mobile reactor. So this is designed not for civilian applications, but specifically for forward operating applications or something like that for the Department of War. And so this is actually the delivery of the fuel. And this fuel, the entire supply line needs to be designed around these new advanced reactor technologies. And so this is the first delivery of TRISO fuel, which is the first time this fuel has been fabricated for, you know, a real actual field deployment. And so that was delivered in January to Idaho National Lab, which is, again, so there's like this progress being made pretty continually. This is a newer initiative that I feel like Alaskans maybe are not quite as familiar with, but Alaska is definitely a consideration here. This is Project Janus. The same person who actually organized Project Pele is now leading Project Janus. And so this is really this attempt to use Department of War resources to really start to deploy these at multiple bases. So we're not just building one of, but really trying to get from a first-of-a-kind design to an nth of a kind, because we need to get to a place where the economics start to make sense for these reactors. And so what they're doing is they've actually identified 9 sites around the country that might host one of these, and there's multiple companies that are participating in this particular program, and Fort Wainwright is one that has been identified as a potential host for one of these reactors. So this would be a second project unrelated to the Eielson reactor that would also take place in Alaska, potentially.
Senator Stevens has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we talk more and more about ADAC, which would be a naval facility, and no renewables out there, any possibility of the Navy, they have nuclear reactors on submarines, would that be a possibility for them in development of ADAC?
Thank you, Senator Stevens, through the chair. One thing in that document, I put in a lot of responses to frequently asked questions. If there's ones that you that you think of that we didn't include, that please let me know. But that is one that we have heard quite a lot, and so so we did include that in the frequently asked questions in this. And the issue with this concept of an advanced reactor doesn't really relate to the size of the reactor. And I think that that's one thing that there's been some misunderstanding about before. There's very small reactors in existence now, like physically small in terms of power output, that are not in this like category of advanced reactors, or the ones that have inherent safety features associated with them. So two examples. One would be the Fort Greely reactor. So there was an actual nuclear reactor that was operating here in Alaska. That was a small reactor. In fact, it was more like a naval reactor brought onshore, essentially. Those reactors, so whether it's the Fort Greely one or the one or ones from a nuclear sub or some kind of a naval vessel, those use very enriched uranium. It's quite different than what you would use for civilian nuclear and really wouldn't be safe for civilian applications, both because of proliferation concerns and just making sure that you're they're certainly not going to have this negative reactivity coefficient where you do need to be removing heat from that reactor continually, which works pretty well when you're in the ocean, right? But it's really not a possibility under the way that they are currently, that they're designed. But there has been a lot of experience that we've continued to gain over time from naval reactor designs. And so a lot of the companies that are now building these reactors have continued to build that experience over time by working on naval reactors.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
What is the timeline for the Eielson project, for the Wainwright project?
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So there are still currently saying that the reactor at Fort Wainwright should be operational by 2028. I haven't heard anything different from that. I personally believe that's a very optimistic timeline. However, that's still what they're publicly stating today. These Project Janus initiative reactors, the idea would be that some of those will start to become come online in a test kind of capacity relatively soon, like the Project Pele reactor, Project Marvel reactor, which is an experimental reactor that will stay at Idaho National Lab. Those are expected to come online this year. So, yeah.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
What's been the holdup? Because the military's been using these nuclear subs for decades, right? What's been the holdup with the transition to putting it on land? It would seem to be easier to do it on land.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So one of the issues has really been around the licensing of these reactor designs. The Department of War has its own separate process for licensing these reactors that doesn't touch the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at all. The same thing with these projects here, like the Project Janus initiative projects. They're not being licensed through the Department of War. They're being licensed through the Department of Energy, which has a separate approach for licensing of test reactors. So ones, again, that are just purely test reactors that are not going to be used for commercial power. And so there's a streamlined licensing process for both Department of Energy and Department of War. When you're looking at full commercial designs, it needs to go through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There's a long history with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're really not, they were not established with the idea of trying to accelerate licensing of these kinds of devices. Their job is to protect public safety. So they're very risk adverse as an organization. There hasn't really been a new reactor other than the Vogtle reactor that I mentioned in Georgia that's been licensed in decades. So there's a lot of knowledge that's been lost. And so one of the things that that the administration in D.C. is trying to do right now is really try to accelerate the licensing of these reactors and try to create create a carve-out for these small reactors, these advanced reactors, so that they could be permitted in a slightly different process and timeline, understanding that they're smaller, there's less concern related to environmental contamination. And these pilot projects are going to help generate a lot of data, because at the end of the day, if you're just reliant on models, the NRC is going to be very hesitant to put the public at risk based on modeled assumptions, versus now that we're going to actually have real-world operating test reactors, we'll be able to use real data, and that should really speed up the licensing process, which has been a big part of the holdup.
Follow up.
And do you have a sense of how much per kilowatt hour it would cost to operate one of these microreactors?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the economics of these is a huge question that Alaskans have, that people everywhere have. And the costs related to what the final licensing requirements are going to be in terms of how they're operated, safety requirements and things like that do have a lot of impact on what the end cost is going to be. My answer that I prefer to give is that there are many vendors, dozens of vendors, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on trying to get these technologies to market. They're very aware of what the market price for power is today, and they are certainly believe that they could meet or beat that. In the document that I shared with you, I don't think that any Alaskan should be thinking that that a nuclear project could somehow get them very inexpensive power anytime in the near future. I think that realistically, we're looking at something that's sort of similar, and I don't just mean in Alaska, but just sort of more broadly to the delivered cost of power. So it's really about some of these other attributes that would be the reason why you would decide to move forward with this. So I mentioned things like, for example, data centers. They require a large energy load, not just for power, but also for cooling. And a lot of locations don't necessarily have excess power. We may not here in Alaska, for example, be able to power a data center. So if there's some sort of a nuclear battery that can come along with a data center, that might be a different approach. And that's the kind of thing that's being explored.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, I do have a question, because there's a lot of these smaller commercialized reactor companies that are coming up. The president just recently said that they're sent $1 billion to sort of reinitiate the Three Mile Island project, and so larger nuclear. I'm wondering if that has had a chilling effect at all on some of these smaller nuclear companies, or is the growth of these small nuclear companies still at projected levels based on Department of Defense initiatives?
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. I have personally been seeing that there's a huge amount of support at the federal level for these advanced reactor designs. I think one of the concerns is just that it takes a while to get them online, and sites that are already sort of licensed or approved. So there's two parts to the licensing process. There's the site license and there's the technology license. And so that's one thing that we can be thinking about in Alaska, is looking at what the site licensing requirements might be for a reactor that would be specific to Alaska. But for a place like Three Mile Island or, other places that are already licensed for a nuclear device and well understood, constrained in terms of what the limitations are there, that makes the site license not something you have to worry about. You have to worry about the technology license for the device itself. And so that streamlines the process and speeds it up a little bit.
Thanks, Doctor.
Yeah. So this is an example of the picture here. This was taken just last week or a little bit over a week ago, maybe. So this is putting a reactor vessel. This is about a it's not actually fueled. It's just an empty reactor vessel on a C-17 as part of this Project Janus, with the idea of can we move these reactors around by air? What does this look like? This also did not get a lot of attention in Alaska, but a big part of when you look at these news stories, it's like, hey, if we're going to take a reactor to Alaska, we're probably going to bring it on a plane. This is how we would do it. And so so that's just kind of interesting. Again, they're taking all these small steps to figure out the logistics, the supply chain. All of this is sort of being worked on behind the scenes. And, we're not necessarily seeing all that happen right here in Alaska. So these are just a couple other projects I thought I would mention. These are larger reactor projects. So this is a TerraPower natrium reactor. So this is a slightly different design. This is a single 300 megawatt reactor. I guess I didn't put that in here. But this is in Kemmerer, Wyoming, at the very close to where there's a closing coal-fired project and or old plant. And so this is one that has been heavily financed by Bill Gates. And so a lot of large funding sources behind this particular project. So this is moving forward with target operation in early 2030s. So 300 megawatts is more similar to a size that would make sense potentially for the rail belt. There's other reactor companies that are looking at similar sorts of designs. I mentioned Westinghouse earlier. They have an AP300 megawatt reactor design. That's the kind of thing that realistically for the rail belt would probably make more sense than like a smaller reactor if that was ever considered. Here's another one that's actively under development. This is in Tennessee, Kairos. So they're actually building this test reactor there. This is at Oak Ridge National Lab instead of at Idaho National Lab. And in this case, they're just looking at a thermal reactor. So this is just going to be, at least in this first iteration, they're just worried about providing heat, not about the power generation component. One thing about these reactors, they produce heat. They're essentially just a heat engine. And so you still need to convert that heat to some form of usable power if that's what you're trying to do, create electricity. And so that power conversion side of things is often conventionally with steam generation, but at least with the smaller reactor designs, there's opportunities for different cycles to be considered as well. So this is a real picture too. So one thing I thought would be of interest to this group is that we've been doing a series of public polls of Alaskans related to all kinds of energy issues, but one of them is on nuclear energy. And so one of the things that we've really observed is that there is still a pretty big information gap among the general Alaska public. Most Alaskans are either completely unfamiliar with these advanced reactors or have heard very little about them. That's about 3/4 of Alaskans. It has actually gone up a little bit. There was a big jump when around the time that the Eielson reactor was announced, just shortly after that, about a 10% jump in awareness, but it hasn't continued to go up since then. The thing that I think is kind of interesting to this group is that we've noticed that that folks in leadership positions or in the energy industry are far more aware, including members of this body, are much more familiar with nuclear energy than the general public is. So this is an area where leadership across the state, whether it's, you know, community leaders, mayors, utility managers, have a lot more familiarity, at least general familiarity, than the public does. And the reason why that's sort of important is that with this second chart here, is that when people are more familiar with the technology, they tend to be more supportive of it. And so that's just something to sort of be aware of. Folks that are more familiar tend, not always, there's still some that certainly oppose it, but typically there's a higher level of support for the technology when people become more familiar with it. In this case, this is from our general public poll where we provided a statement about what a micro reactor is, asked before and after, whether they were supportive of this as a consideration in Alaska. And you can see that it changed by 28%. Now, again, this isn't necessarily like a permanent change in those people's opinion. This is just kind of before and after reading a pretty simple statement. But it shows that there's a lot of uncertainty among Alaskans about whether they're supportive or not or what this is. So that's just something to be aware of, because I think there's still a lot of education that needs to be done. So this is actually a roadmap we put together in 2011 about kind of like a little bit of a decision tree on when or how Alaskans should be thinking about nuclear energy. And it's kind of interesting to me because back in 2011, there was very few manufacturers of like small reactors at that time. We kind of lumped it into like there's three things that we should be thinking about, like is the technology real? Does it exist? Like, that's kind of a first important question. You know, is it safe? Is it environmentally responsible? And is it economic, right? Those are sort of the four big buckets of questions that Alaskans are asking that I think are reasonable to get answers to, because, you know, it might exist, it might be safe, but if it's not economic, we're probably not interested in it, right? So those are the kinds of things that we kind of created this decision tree, but we talked about a potential pilot project in the 2030s. And, you know, actually, we're still kind of on track for about what we were thinking about back then. So just want to mention another big question Alaskans often have is about the kind of the life cycle of nuclear. They're interested in the mining and they're interested in the final disposal of spent fuel. There's a lot of questions around that. In the U.S., spent fuel is the responsibility of the federal government, so it's not really something that Alaska actually has control over, I guess, specifically, beyond just being one state in the country. I should say, and this will be relevant here in a minute with it, I think hopefully another slide I put in here, but the Alaska state statutes currently prohibit the storage of spent nuclear fuel in the state of Alaska. Any nuclear fuel that's moved within the state can only be moved for the purpose of removing it from the state. So our state statutes prohibit that right now. So because this is the Arctic Affairs Committee, I thought I would just mention I had the chance to visit Finland really recently and go and see their permanent geologic repository. It's the first of this kind anywhere in the world, where they're going to be starting to place spent nuclear fuel in these tunnels beginning this year. And so that's kind of cool to see what they've been doing there. And the U.S. is really working on trying to accelerate developing a plan also for a long-term repository. Oh, here's they're storing them in these caskets, in these copper caskets, which I thought was pretty interesting. So that's like a fuel assembly or a pretend fuel assembly on the right there, and it slides into that copper casket. They backfill everything with bentonite. It's really relatively simple. Bentonite will expand if there's any water that gets, you know, anywhere close to it and stuff like that. And so it kind of seals and stores, you know, this. And so they're going to be putting fuel in there for 100 years. And then those caskets should last for 100,000 years is what their design, the life design. So I just thought I'd throw this out because, again, this Arctic Affairs, so this is from Iceland. I think this is, you know, we often, like, get very stuck on the current technology and, like, what we're looking at and the decisions before us today, for example, with natural gas supply and things. And so it can be more difficult to really think about totally transitional technologies. And so this is an article in a 1908 paper in Reykjavik. And so what I like to challenge people to do is sort of guess what technology they're talking about here. And so, you know, it says engineers of our time may design many peculiar inventions. So this is just it's Icelandic, right? So some of them seem so astonishing. They seem like fabrications, yet time and time again, what was once thought impossible has proved achievable, reminding us to be cautious before dismissing any idea, however implausible it may first appear. So what's the technology that they're talking about in 1908? So
that must have been nuclear.
It was not nuclear. It's geothermal district heating.
Oh.
It's geothermal district heating. And so today, 95% of Icelanders get all of their heat from geothermal district heating. But at the time this was written, they had heard about this town, Boise, Idaho, that had a district heating system. And they were like, could that really? Is that possible? Like, could you do that? And so they couldn't really fathom it because they're like, well, you know, we've got these hot springs, but how would you collect the water? Like, what would that look like? How would you actually heat homes with it? And so they actually they sent a group, including the mayor of Reykjavik, to Boise. They wrote the mayor first, and then they sent this group of people there to Boise, Idaho, to understand how they did it there, came back to Iceland, and they started doing it themselves and testing it and trying it out. And they wound up now being like the global experts on, you know, geothermal district heating. And 95% of people, you take it for granted when you're there. The Icelanders absolutely take it for granted. So we went back and kind of looked at these old newspaper articles because it's very clear that there was a point in time where people didn't think that this was a doable thing. They assumed they would have to continue to heat their homes with coal and peat and, you know, eventually like use diesel generators for electric power. But so it's, I do kind of view nuclear, it's a little bit nearer term, right? But we are always thinking, oh, it's something for the future. We're not sure it's really something for today. But I do think it's worth, you know, keeping these sorts of things in mind that technology changes. And I do think that nuclear could be something that could be pretty transformative and that we should, as Alaskans, be making sure we're at least considering it when we're making decisions about our energy future. And I think that's the end of that. So I might stop there, and that may be all we have time for.
Well, that was great, Dr. Holdman.
Yeah.
But I think we have time to go on to the okay. rural energy generation
okay.
pieces.
Okay. Okay, and this will be shorter, so I'll acknowledge that. So so this is a map that I've shown this committee before. This is called what we call the Electric North. It's actually kind of a construct or definition that we've kind of come up with ourselves because it basically shows all the places that are north of the interconnected continental electric grid in both Europe and North America and Asia. And so so everything north of that light blue line is not electrically interconnected with the rest of the continental grid. So you're either getting power from something like a small regional grid, like our rail belt grid in Alaska or Southeast Power Association grid, or in Canada. So those are kind of those like green amoeba looking things or yellow ones, depending on whether they have majority renewables or majority fossil fuel, or else it's remote communities, right, that are largely dependent on diesel fuel. And so sort of breaking up the Arctic and the way we think about energy in the north, we think it's pretty important to acknowledge that there's places that are pretty far south that share a lot of factors in terms of how they get their energy with northern communities as well, especially in Canada. And so this is something when we're thinking about energy issues, especially for remote communities, we want to acknowledge that this is a pretty big part of the world geographically. This represents about 20% of the world's land mass that lives north of this boundary. This is just a slightly different map. This is all on online, so we have this as like a database that anyone can access and look at and play with. And so there's a lot of data behind it that we use to try to understand how different communities and different countries are managing their energy supply. I checked the last time I actually presented to this committee. I talked a lot about some of the policy differences, especially around the use of subsidies for rural communities. And so I thought I would just very quickly highlight that again because I think it's a good place to start. You know, rural Alaska, as you are very well aware, has a very high energy burden compared to many places in the country. That little chart on the left there, the line at the very top shows small communities that are PCE eligible. So this is the average cost of power in those communities before PCE is applied. So that also means that all of the users of electric power in those communities that aren't eligible for PCE, that is what they're paying. And you can see that's many times higher, like five times higher than the national average, but it's also several times higher than even the average in Alaska. And so the average for PCE for communities that have more than 1,000 residents is a little, you know, quite a bit below that. But so our small communities are really overburdened. And so you can see in this map, which is a little bit of like a heat map of different regions in the state, it's the places that have small communities, a lot of small communities, and lower medium household income. So it's both of those, the denominator and the numerator, that impact their energy burden. So this is kind of broken up more by region. And so you can see the U.S. average there. And the threshold for what's considered high energy burden in the U.S., just kind of as a definition, is considered above 6% of your household energy is spent related to specifically to energy expenditures. So you can see a big part of Alaska is above that. And so for Fairbanks, for example, where I live, it's pretty close to it averages around 10%. So it's fairly high. just going to PCE again, I realize this committee is pretty familiar with a lot of this information, but you know, PCE really only covers, when you look at the amount of money it costs to generate a certain volume of power in these rural communities, PCE is only covering a very small proportion of that overall. So we think of it as like, oh, maybe a third of the consumers in most communities are eligible, the kilowatt hour sales are eligible for PCE, but PCE is still only paying for a portion of that cost to generate power, even so. And so it's still a relatively small proportion compared to the overall cost to generate power. And I just kind of want to remind other Alaskans of that. I did share this slide the last time, but I still think it's pretty interesting. When you look at the subsidy, which is the PCE program, and it is a subsidy that we pay out for rural Alaska, it's quite a bit lower than other places in the north. And so I just want to acknowledge that as well. The shaded area for Nunavut is because they have a lot of fluctuation in terms of like how much they're actually what proportion of the power is subsidized based on the budget that they're receiving. A lot of that is a pass through from the federal government, so it goes up and down a little bit. Just a couple other things. I just want to acknowledge that all of the charts that I'm showing right now come from my PhD dissertation. So I've created these or have had help from some of my colleagues in creating a few of these. But one thing that I also think is interesting is that that we've really, Alaska has been a real leader, like for example, in rural energy renewables development. And you're all very familiar with that. One of the things I think is pretty interesting is that we've had a lot more longevity in terms of leadership within our utility industry than in other places in the north, and I think that that's actually really, really important to recognize. In fact, I'd like to specifically call out Kodiak as a place that has been a real leader within Alaska, and part of that has really been about longevity of leadership that's been able, they've had a vision, and they've been able to enact that over time because they've had really stable leadership, for example, there, and they're one of the ones that bumped that up there. In fact, I think that top level, like 30, 35 years, that comes from Kodiak. So, and the same thing, like I then really have taken a closer look at AVEC in particular, the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, and it's not just leadership within AVEC that they've had a lot of stability, but it's also like the board members, for example. There's been a lot of stability around overarching leadership of that cooperative, especially compared to like places in Canada. Often what you see is that somebody will come from the like from the south, right, and take on a job as the leader of a utility in the north for maybe partway through their career as sort of like a stepping stone to getting a job elsewhere, or maybe as a capstone, like kind of the end of their career. They're like want to hang around for a few years and work in the north, but they're not really making that a career. And in Alaska, it's very much like our rural utility. We know this to be true, but we don't think about that as unique or different. And so the fact that the folks that are running many of these rural utilities are doing that across a career and are able to build on the expertise and knowledge that they build has been something that's been unique and has been part of our special sauce in Alaska. So I just want to mention that. Just to continue on the AVEC thread a little bit, we did do a fairly extensive study focusing on Southwest Alaska, which is, of course, a region that's been recently had some pretty devastating impacts related to flooding from the storm last fall. But this region has about half AVEC communities and about half independent utilities. And so it was a really good region to kind of look at when you look at the median community there. They have the AVEC communities, if anything, are slightly smaller. They were all about the same size even when AVEC was formed. We're kind of looking at which communities joined AVEC, which ones didn't, what were the attributes of those communities. And I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but essentially, largely kind of an accident of history of which communities became AVEC communities and which ones didn't. And there's a lot of similarity in terms of like distance from the coast, different distance from Bethel, you know, different attributes of the communities today. And so what we were interested in is like, how much of a difference does it make if you're in a community that is an AVEC community versus the average community that is an independent utility. And again, you know, there's utilities of all kinds that are well managed and less well managed, and so this is a little bit on average. And so I do want to acknowledge that. But when you look at that, this is maybe looks a little bit messy, but the purple is AVEC. The pink is non-AVEC, so you see there's much larger, you know, much larger differences with the non-AVEC communities, which you would expect because they're not necessarily working together. And so, you know, AVEC has a lower average retail rate, and they have a lower average effective rate. So that's the stuff. So they're doing a better job of squeezing every dollar they can, or just basically figuring out all of their expenditures and correctly submitting that paperwork or those numbers, basically, to AEA and RCA. But at the end of the day, they actually cost the PCE program significantly less because they're actually getting a smaller subsidy payout because they're being more efficient in how they're generating power. And so they're actually saving the PCE program just for this region about $300,000 a year, while they're saving people that live in the communities something around $150,000 a year on average in cash that they're not sending out of the community because AVEC is doing a better job, again, on average, right, of managing those electric systems in those individual communities. So, and then this just kind of basically is a little bit of the math on that. We're actually working on updating this right now. It's actually probably a little bit better than what it shows on this chart. So we're trying to do a little bit of a more robust analysis, but the concept holds. And so for the region, AVEC is saving about $1.7 million a year to residents of the region that are in AVEC communities compared to non-AVEC communities. And it, like I said, they're also saving the PCE program at the same time about $300,000. It might be a little bit more than that right now a year. And so I just want to acknowledge that this is about like pooling of resources and trying to get a little bit more bang for your buck, you know, than individual communities that it's very difficult for them, you know, sometimes to manage their individual energy systems. So I thought it would be interesting to share that with you. So. And that's it. That's really all I have. These are just kind of the takeaways, which I just basically said. Yes. So.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Holdman. You know, this data is so impressive. Well, of course, it's part of your mm-hmm. doctoral dissertation
yes.
as well. Just for a little history, you were the founder of ASAP. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct.
How long ago was that?
So I founded the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I wrote a proposal to the university to start this research program. That was in 2007. We founded it in January 2008, and I was the only employee at the time. So it really was just kind of a from the ground up effort because we recognized there was really a need for the university or an organization within the state to be working more directly with our communities. And so we really tried to do a program that was different from like a conventional academic program that's focused on the ivory tower. My colleagues and I, we try to get out. We try to really work with communities all across the state and make sure we're generating research and information that's directly relevant to the current decisions that we're making today all across Alaska. And there's 80 of us today. So we've grown quite a lot.
The other thing that's remarkable is how quickly you put together data. You've been collecting it all this time, and when you're asked a question, you can typically put it together fairly quickly. Sort of contrast to the Institute of Social and Economic Research, which takes much longer. So I really appreciate that. Any questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Stevens.
Oh, just a comment. You mentioned that the longevity of the managers of these various REAs are really important, but the boards are just, at least in my community, I can name four people who have been on that board for 40 years. And that brings the maybe 30 years. 40 might be stretching, but at least 30 years. And I mean, that means that people have been a long-time associate. They've been going through a lot of training. Always amazed. Well, I see a member out there who's had a lot of experience with Kodiak and Cordova. That they have their members have well trained, and I know you're not directly related to the REAs, but it certainly is an important part of all of this, right?
Yeah, I think Senator Stevens, through the chair, I think that rural utilities really there's a lot that I am very continually impressed by our rural communities. They're really doing some amazing things, and we should give them all a pat on the back when we see them for their work that they're doing. So I mentioned Kodiak earlier. You just referenced Cordova, for example. You know, they're doing some incredibly innovative things in rate design, in like coming up with different rates and thinking differently about how they structure rates there. So they're trying to do things like incentivizing consumers to use heat pumps, for example. And they're able to do some of that innovation because they're not economically regulated through the RCA, so they're able to make decisions at the community level quickly, and they're taking advantage of that, the knowledge that they have, the understanding they have of their community, to try things out, to do things differently, to be willing to maybe fail and then course correct where they need to. And so I think we have a lot to learn from these rural communities and the utilities that operate them that I think that we don't appreciate as much as we should.
Very good. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Dr. Holdman. This was a great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
The second item on our agenda today is a resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 24. This recognizes and honors the relationship between Alaska and Greenland. So to address this, I will ask my staff to come forward and just do a brief overview of the resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Giesel. So as Chair Giesel mentioned, Senate Joint Resolution 24 recognizes and honors the longstanding relationship between the United States of America and Greenland and underscores the importance of continued cooperation between the United States and the Kingdom of Denmark in the Arctic. As Arctic partners, the United States and Greenland share strategic, economic, and security interests. Alaska Native peoples and the Inuit peoples of Greenland share cultural, linguistic, and historical connections that continue to shape Arctic identity, resilience, and stewardship. They share common knowledge, common challenges regarding remote communities with a high cost of living, concerns with food security, and climate change results like melting sea ice and coastal erosion. Arctic stability relies on collaborative resource management, shared defense, trade, scientific research, and transportation. Conversations at the federal level have raised concerns that action taken without concern of this critical partnership could undermine a long-established cooperation, especially through the Arctic Council. And so progress in the Arctic depends on strong relationships with trusted partners, particularly Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark.
Thank you, Paige. So the impetus for this was the discussions on the federal level that could really disrupt this collaborative and this friendship that we have with other Arctic nations, Denmark, and by extension, Greenland. So that was the purpose of this resolution, was to really underscore that. You see it in the Be It Resolves, honor the relationship, affirm the importance of continued cooperation, strengthen collaboration, and that commitment to fostering friendship, mutual respect, and long-term cooperation. So, any discussion from committee members? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. A question, I guess, to the sponsor of the resolution. I support the resolution. I'll just say for the record, we just recently read a resolution across that's currently in the hands of the Senate, and it is on a gas line. But I guess the underlying story is that it's a big sort of like nod to the president and the administration. I mean, most of it has to do with that. I'm wondering if people might take this as potentially a slam to the president, even though that may not be the intent.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Well, certainly there will be people that have that mindset. On the other hand, there's people who recognize that the Arctic communities, the Arctic circumpolar countries, have such shared values, such shared culture. The people groups that populate the circumpolar have shared values and even language and cultural history. And that's what really is what we're trying to emphasize here. The Arctic has been noted, the circumpolar Arctic has been noted for its peaceful collaboration. And this is intended to emphasize that and a desire to maintain it. Senator Stevens, did you have your hand up?
I was just going to comment. I mean, there is historical truth. And comments we've heard about U.S. owning Greenland during World War II, simply not true. If you have any reflections on that, I mean, we've never owned Greenland. We had a working relationship with it. But that is the truth. I don't know if you want to include anything like that in, but it's no intention to really slam the administration. But I think facts are facts.
Thank you. Further comments? All right, seeing none. I was going to open public comment today, and so at this time I will open public comment on Senate Joint Resolution 24. And I am not seeing anyone online that wishes to testify. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 24? Seeing no one, I will close public comment. So at this time, we'll set the resolution aside. If there are any amendments that folks may wish to offer, I'll set an amendment deadline for March 4th. That's next week at 5 p.m. So that concludes our agenda for today. Thank you for joining us. Our next meeting will be scheduled for May 5th. And at this time, the only thing on our agenda is this resolution. So we'll see if other things get added, but right now it'll just be reconsidering this. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 2:31 p.m.